NBC.
This is Mary Buck, calling from Antwerp, Turkey. The news of the bombing by the Japanese of Pearl Harbor in Manila was received in Ankara just 4 hours ago. All embassies and journalists in Ankara were immediately informed. Telephone lines were completely tied up for an hour and a half. At Ankara's famous restaurant, Carpenter's, where I received the news, there was a queue lined up at the telephone booth. Immediate reaction throughout diplomatic and press circles was one of stupefaction. The consensus here is that a resolution will be introduced into Congress within 24 or 48 hours at the latest. Some Japanese in Ankara, who have had an opportunity to study the new order in the Balkans, are very unhappy about the situation. The success of the new regime is measurable. Witness the stories of neutral travelers from Greece, corroborated by intelligence sources here. In one single day last week, 800 persons died of starvation in Athens and the Piraeus. The awful famine in Greece is killing nearly 200 men, women, and Greek children per day. I have received information today from trusted sources, information documented and detailed, about what is happening in Greece. First, the famine is countrywide. Athens, Piraeus, Greece, and the islands. Men and women fall in the streets and die. Beggars are everywhere. Red Cross kitchens work frantically, trying to feed 100,000, 200,000 or more people every day. Greece never had more than 2 weeks' food reserves during the war. When I was in Athens, just before the end, my diet was strictly military. Canned salmon, beans, bully beef, maybe an occasional fresh tomato. When the Germans bombed the Piraeus, the Athenians scooped up the dead fish killed by the bomb concussion, and then there was feasting. But during the war, the Greeks could eat. Now they cannot. Bulgaria has seized the wheatlands of Thrace and Macedonia. The Germans and Italians requisitioned reserve foodstuffs. Only a limited number of fishermen they put out in their caiques. Greeks have been known to go fishing and sail on to free Turkey. There is no fish, no meat, no wheat, no bread. And the Italians take even the vegetables. And in the parks of Athens, after twilight, the Italian soldiers offer a loaf of bread to Greek women as payment for companionship. There are no medicines for the Greeks and no hospitals. The hospitals of Greece are jammed to bursting with more than 50,000 wounded German soldiers from the Russian front. There are no surgical instruments, and a Greek with appendicitis is doomed to die. In Istanbul, Turkey, tonight, the Turkish steamer Kurtuluş is loading again for the first time with food supplies for Greece. Potatoes, dried fruits and vegetables, sheep and lamb. But this is only a drop in the bucket. It does not even feed one man or woman in 1,000, although famine is lowering that percentage daily. Those four horsemen, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, are riding over Greek's capital and the provinces and those beautiful islands. In Greece and Thrace, Greek patriots are fighting against their enemies, the Bulgars. But elsewhere, there is less and less fighting. You can't fight well when you're slowly dying of famine. Italian communiques report food shipments to Greece, and reliable information confirms the report. The Italians have food and plenty of it, and butter on their bread, 3 times a day. This is Mary Buck, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company.
That was Ankara, Turkey, next to Britain's military headquarters in the Near East. Grant Parr reports direct from Cairo.
It's always dangerous to make generalizations, but if I may make one about the German army, it's this. The Germans are superb when they can make war on their own terms, according to their own plans, with their own equipment. But they are sometimes upset by unexpected turns in the battle and by weapons not their own. This accounts for the unexpected effectiveness of the British bayonet. It may explain the equally unexpected effectiveness of small British units called mobile columns. When British and German tanks resumed battle south of Sidi Rezegh yesterday, the Germans retained almost none of the strategic advantage they gained when they split the New Zealand lines last week. British columns, working with the Royal Air Force, had harried the German tank forces out of the Rasig area, materially relieving the Tobruk situation. Mobile columns had cleared most of the region between Tobruk and the frontier of Germans and Italians. They had dipped below the new German positions around El Gubi and El Adam and done significant damage to the fringes. Most important of all, they had destroyed 49 Axis tanks in 3 days, burned or captured thousands of gallons of Axis petrol, and captured hundreds of prisoners, swelling the number to well above 8,000. Without meeting the main German tank force at all, mobile columns have changed the entire aspect of the battle. What at first seemed to be a danger setback has become little more than an incident. The Germans seem definitely on the defensive again. The mobile column can scarcely be termed a purely British invention. It is a big brother of the mechanized patrols which both sides have used to raid and gain information during the various desert blitzkriegs. But just as the British have proven adept at such desert patrolling, they have taken these larger patrols and turned them into one of the most formidable weapons of desert warfare. With tank strength dropping rapidly on both sides, infantry is coming into its own. Yet ordinary marching infantry is, and probably always will be, next to useless on the desert. The answer to this problem, and in some cases the answer to the tank itself, is the mobile column. Such a column is based on infantry carried in trucks. But besides these, it usually has a few light tanks and armored cars, several anti-tank and anti-aircraft guns mounted on the backs of Ford and Dodge trucks, some Bren carriers or truck-borne machine guns, light field guns towed by trucks. With the exception of the tanks and Bren carriers, the entire outfit moves on rubber tires. It moves with lightning speed and surprisingly little noise. Unless it is spotted every 5 minutes, no one can tell where it is. It may range for hundreds of miles. It strikes where least expected. It strikes hard. I won't attempt to give you exact positions and details of the numerous operations I've mentioned. Position means almost nothing in desert warfare anyway. But here are a few exploits of mobile columns for you to think about. All occurred within the last 4 days. West of Bardia, a mobile column encountered a small Axis force and destroyed 60 vehicles and a supply dump, captured 100 prisoners. An Indian column attacked semi-prepared Italian positions near Bir El Gubi, destroyed 15 Italian tanks and 150 vehicles. Set fire to 50,000 gallons of gas and oil. New Zealand troops engaged an Axis column west of Menaster, killed about 100 Germans and took 100 prisoners, mostly Italians. Two Axis tanks, several trucks were destroyed and two guns captured. South of El Duda yesterday, British patrols destroyed 15 trucks and two field guns, captured three German anti-tank guns and 25 German prisoners. Other columns, yesterday, destroyed 23 Italian tanks and a fascist field battery. There may be many explanations for the success of these columns. The British themselves explain that their subordinate officers are better trained and more able to take responsibility of the type needed for commanding small, independent forces. I would like to add that 2 years of experience in actual desert warfare is something nearer reality than hothouses in Germany, where the Nazis learned about Libya. But one thing I do know, the mobile columns have made the Libyan battle look good. This is Grant Parr returning you to the National Broadcasting Company.
That was a report direct from Cairo. Our next comes from Blacked Out Britain, where it is now after 1 o'clock on Monday morning. Go ahead, London.
This is London, Fred Bates speaking. The news that Japan has declared a state of war with Britain as well as the United States probably means that there'll be no official British statement tonight. That seems to be the feeling here. Japan's own action removes from Britain any necessity to implement Mr. Churchill's recent within-the-hour declaration. It's thought in London that Great Britain and the United States may issue a joint and simultaneous statement after Congress meets tomorrow. Both the House of Lords and the House of Commons meet at 3 o'clock on Monday. That's 9 o'clock, New York time, in the morning. Both houses will hear a government statement on the situation, undoubtedly a declaration of war. Ambassador Wynant and Mr. Churchill have been together most of today and tonight. The Japanese embassy in London tonight are said to be burning their official documents, but so far, says the embassy, it has no confirmation of Tokyo's action.
late now for reactions here or anyplace else. But here's a statement broadcast by Berlin tonight. The speaker said, as a result of the warmongering of the American President Roosevelt, which during the last week has constantly increased, the first clashes have occurred in East Asia between Japanese and American forces. Thus, said the Nazi broadcaster, this warmonger number one has at last attained his goal and has succeeded in bringing war to his people. There are many observers here whose comment on that statement might be that opportunists in Tokyo have judged the time right to serve their own interests as partners in a world domination venture. Sir Robert Clive, British ambassador to Tokyo from 1934 to 37, has written an historical survey, according to which Japanese aggression is nothing new. Their aggressive expansion in the Far East, he says, can be traced back to the 16th century. It lulled during a so-called seclusion period when Japan shut herself off from the world from 1600 to 1850. But she came out of these dormant 250 years sounding the old aggressive expansion note. As early as 1936, he refers there to the fortifying and creating of submarine bases in the Marianne and Caroline group of islands east of the Philippines. The Japanese, he says, had refused his request to visit those islands as their ships, the British ships, had visited other ports under Japanese control. The former ambassador describes the Japanese fleet as formidable, but untested since 1905. Then he goes on to Japan's greatest potential danger in a war with Britain and the United States, which is, of course, the shortage of essential raw materials. And amongst these, he mentions iron ore, manganese, oil, wool, hide, cotton, and rubber. He qualifies his mention of Japan's shortages with the significant phrase, unless she can get them by force. This is no time for loose talk, for easy phrases. People throughout our country have watched war from a distance with varying degrees of various reactions. They'll see it now in a different light. It has been brought home to us today with the reports of Japanese war vessels in action 600 miles off our Pacific coast. Many of us will see it in a different light because we'll feel interest of the United States definitely at stake. There are people at home who believe that our interests, our real long-term interests, are no more at stake now than they have been since Germany went into Czechoslovakia. There are plenty of people at home who've urged preparation, adequate defense against the inevitable. But these were the men and women of vision, people who don't need to burn a hand to learn what fire is like. It seems impossible from over here to think that there won't be others who review their own opinions and their own responses to those who've issued warnings these last few years. There must be some of them who feel themselves very like the Britishers they criticized as being slow or as a Peter. Geographically, if Japan hadn't taken the initiative and been fast off the mark, if Tokyo had played a waiting, come-and-getter strategy, this trouble, which has been popularly considered our trouble, but is really everybody's, would have been farther away than the war in Europe. For the man in Omaha, Nebraska, for instance, he's roughly 7,000 miles from Tokyo, but only about 4,200 miles from London and a little less than 6,000 miles from Moscow. Japan has shown what preparation and initiative can do to distances. There's no tendency here to underestimate the serious trouble she'll probably cause, and no doubt about the eventual outcome. We return you now to New York.
That was London reporting. Before we move to the nation's capital with the further developments on the advent of war in the Pacific, we wish to announce that at 11:30 p.m. tonight, Eastern Standard Time, and again at 12 midnight, over many of these stations and over the combined network of the National Broadcasting Company, we will bring you a series of broadcasts and pick-up points from various NBC commentators and observers at strategic points in the world situation. That's at 11:30 and at 12 Eastern Standard Time tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, an important announcement has just been handed to me. The National Broadcasting Company and its associated stations from coast to coast are planning to operate on a 24-hour basis. Since the declaration of war by the Japanese government on the United States, the latest bulletins and flashes have been brought to you as they were received in the NBC newsrooms, either in New York, Washington, Hollywood, San Francisco, in Honolulu, and in Manila. In keeping with the Secretary of War's request for defense preparations on all plants engaged in defense work, NBC and its associated stations have frequently broadcast announcements to that effect throughout the country. We repeat, the Secretary of War's request that all plants engaged in defense work or which have defense contracts should make plans to protect those plants from sabotage. Also, Army and Navy personnel on the Pacific Coast and the Atlantic areas have been asked to report to their stations, air bases, and ships at once. NBC's outlets, both in New York and on the California coast, are being protected by special police guards. The NBC listening posts are on a 24-hour basis, and the California Highway Patrol has detailed special guards at the NBC broadcasting stations in order that the news coming from the Pacific will not be interfered with. And now, we go down to the nation's capital for Borkage reporting from the newsroom in Washington.
Borkage talking from the newsroom of the executive offices of the White House in Washington. And I want to say first that according to the latest news, we, the president, is disposed to feel that it is possible that Manila has not been bombed. He has also been on the telephone with Governor Poindexter of Hawaii, who confirms the news of great damage there, both property and life, including in the city. While he was telephoning with the governor in Honolulu, the governor announced that another wave of planes was coming over. That's some time ago. Right now, the president is upstairs in his study, dictating to Miss Tully, his secretary, and getting together a rough draft of the message, which he will read to his cabinet when they meet with him at 8:30, and which he will deliver to Congress as soon as possible, probably tomorrow. Many believe that the message will ask for an open declaration of war against Japan. Senator George is one of the senators who believes so. The enemy bombers appeared over Pearl Harbor at about 7:55 a.m., as you have heard, a dawn attack. The news was immediately flashed to the president. He called Secretary Early at his home and Early called the press and radio. The bulletin went out at 2:24 p.m. this afternoon. Early hurried to the White House. By the time the president had his second piece of news, an elaboration of the first bulletin, NBC had its microphone set up here in this crowded newsroom of the White House, which is meant to accommodate about 12 people usually, and there are about 50 crowded around here now. I mention that simply to show you how every effort is being made to get the news to the people. And the White House is cooperating, and it's for our convenience. It has been made the one fountainhead where we can concentrate our efforts, although there has been a conference at the White House, and of course across the road at the State Department, they're busily working, and statements have been given out there. Here's a summary of the developments in Washington so far. An hour before the attack took place, Ambassador Nomura and Emissary Kurusu called at the State Department and delivered the reply to Secretary Hull's note of November 26. The answer so angered Secretary Hull that he declared that he had never imagined any government on this planet was capable of uttering such infamous falsehoods. He didn't know, as he explained later, that an attack had started while those Japanese representatives were right there in the room talking with him. Well, by this time, a crowd of reporters had gathered at the White House executive offices, and we were soon called into Secretary Early's office. And then we learned of the dawn attack in Hawaii and learned that it caused this considerable property damage, as I reported just now. Early then went back upstairs to the president's study. And from then on, the bulletins began to come out one after another. And then we received the news and gave it out just as it came down from the president. He called us in. The president himself called in first the Secretary of War, the Secretary of the Navy, the Chief of Staff, General Marshall. We learned from time to time in the various bulletins of the torpedoing of an army transport, fortunately carrying only lumber, 1,300 miles from San Francisco. Later, that an American ship had given distress signal only 600 miles west of San Francisco. And the Secretary earlier read that from a little memorandum that he had made, penciled before him. He looked up and said that, well, that shows that the Japanese submarines are busy. We learned of the attack on Guam. By this time, the president had finished his conference with the War and Navy Secretaries and the Chief of Staff and called in Miss Tully, his secretary, to begin to dictate, as I said, this rough draft of this message which he read to Congress. In an hour and a half, the cabinet members will assemble, and then at 9:30, they'll be joined by the congressional leaders. Speaker Sam Rayburn, Democratic House Leader McCormick, of course, the Vice President, Republican Leader Martin, and McNary, Senator McNary, Senator Barkley on the Democratic side, or Senator Lester Hill, in case Barkley cannot be reached. They will confer there. Incidentally, Senator Wheeler, leading non-interventionist, has been quoted as saying that he expected there would be a declaration of war and that we would have to see it through. Well, we'll have to see it through. That's all from Washington at the moment, and thanks very much.
That was Borkage reporting from the nation's capital. Before we go overseas, we wish to announce that throughout the evening, NBC will continue to broadcast the latest news, including a roundtable conference to be heard at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time over many of these stations. That's approximately 4 hours from now. Commentators will discuss the war and the latest developments, and the commentators include H.V. Carlton Bourne, William Hillman, and John W. Vandercook, and Robert St. John in New York. From Washington will be heard the voices of Borkage, Wilfred Fleischer, the former editor of the Tokyo Advertiser in Tokyo, and E.K. Lindley of Newsweek. From the Pacific Coast, Upton Close, NBC's authority on the Far East, will join this roundtable discussion. At midnight, Eastern Standard Time tonight, NBC will broadcast spot reports from the scene, giving the South American and other reactions to the war. NBC's newsmen will be heard from Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, and Panama, also from London and other world capitals. Also throughout the night, editorial reactions from the leading newspapers of the nation will be heard over many of these stations, giving the various countries' press reactions on the Japanese war on the United States. And now we switch network controls to San Francisco for news on the Far East.
We take you now to Manila.
Hello, NBC. This is Bert Simon speaking to you again from Manila. It was announced a few moments ago by the Commander-in-Chief of the Japanese Army and Navy Forces in Shanghai that the Japanese have taken over the international settlement in Shanghai and have declared martial law there. All banks in Shanghai have been ordered closed with the promise that arrangements would be made as soon as possible to carry on business to some extent at least. The public has been warned against doing any damage to buildings or a public property with the threat of being shot immediately if they do so. The American consulate has warned all Americans in Shanghai to stay off the street and not to move from one place or another. Here in Manila, troops are being rushed to their battle positions as rapidly as possible. General MacArthur, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Armed Forces in the Far East, made this statement for release just a short time ago. One of the most striking features which has characterized the past few weeks with their uncertainties and anxieties has been the admirable poise of self-control of the people of the Philippines. Nothing can help our military efforts more than a continuation of this calmness and self-restraint. Each individual should continue with fortitude the usual routine and be prepared to carry on with confidence and promptitude such directions from the administration as may be issued for security and well-being. The military is on the alert, and every possible defense measure is being undertaken. My message is one of serenity and confidence. Sir, General, Lieutenant General MacArthur. Here in Manila, the Yokohama Specie Bank in downtown Manila is completely surrounded by armed guards with sawed-off shotguns and machine guns to prevent sabotage or destruction of the bank's funds. It is not officially confirmed whether the personnel of the bank has been taken into custody, but it is expected that they have been. All Japanese stores in Manila failed to open their doors this morning. More about this later when official confirmation can be had. At this moment, the Civil Emergency Administration is working together with General MacArthur's staff on a plan for evacuating the non-essential men, women, and children from Manila. A blackout may be ordered for tonight, although we have received no official word from the Civilian Emergency Administration. Schools will undoubtedly be closed, effective immediately. Many parents kept their children from school this morning and are getting ready to evacuate from Manila. It has been rumored, in fact, a report from London radio this morning had it that Singapore has been attacked by the Japanese at approximately the same time as the attack on the Hawaiian Islands. No definite confirmation of this has been had yet, although we are trying to contact the British consul here to see if he has any word on this rumor. I again say that it was rumored that Singapore was simultaneously attacked by the Japanese this morning at the time of Pearl Harbor and Oahu Island were being bombed. Another radio report. An unnamed transport sunk 1,600 miles out of Manila with 350 lives lost. This has not been confirmed, We called up the Naval Department, and they have no confirmation of this. We also have a radio report to the effect that 700 miles off of San Francisco, a freighter was sunk. This also has not been confirmed. So far, the Manila is calm and apparently confident that the United States Armed Forces here will be able to protect Manila and environs from any attack by the Japanese. There seems to be no last-minute frenzy of the people, and many of them are going about their business as usual. This is Bert Silent speaking. I will be with you again later in the day, and I'm now returning you to NBC.
This is NBC San Francisco, and presenting at this time our Far Eastern Authority, Upton Close.
Hello, Americans. We have an interesting report from Portland saying that the consul there, Mr. Oka, is very surprised and very unhappy over the sudden war in the Pacific. A smoke was going up from the consulate's office. We had an interesting time here in San Francisco, where Mr. Hal Wolf of our San Francisco force went up to see what was happening to the Japanese consulate here. He's going to tell you in just a minute. Take a minute for that, Hal.
I'll do just that. We wandered up to this gray sandstone two-story house of a 2622 Jackson in San Francisco, the home of Yoshio Muto, the Japanese consul general, primarily to see Mr. K. Inagaki, secretary to Mr. Muto. But we arrived, coincidentally, with the San Francisco Fire Department was just one of those things. And that the fire was raging in and around the second-floor bedroom fireplace was also one of those things. Mr. Inagaki, with whom we talked, had no comment in particular to make relative to how the fire started, added only that the fireplace was mostly ornamental and apparently had been used by mistake. However, Captain Larry Dwyer of the San Francisco Fire Department declared that upon his arrival, the area around the fireplace was one roaring blaze and that apparently too many papers had been burned at one time. Generally, we found out that quite a number of people had been in and out of the residence area there in the Pacific Heights section of San Francisco, rather an exclusive residential area, and that quite a number were there. And just as we left, we noted that in front of the consulate home, a large black sedan bearing the Foreign Government License 186 was parked, and that further, that the rear license tag bore the name Argentina.
Thank you, Hal. Well, it all points up to the fact that the Japanese consular force in this country was taken as much off guard as our government was in the action of the Japanese Navy. We are now at war in the Pacific. And the first thing the forces of America have to do is to tend to defense and safety. Second thing they will do is to follow orders from Washington to take the offensive, as and how it is planned out. Guam has been under attack. At the moment, there's a second attack going on over Hawaii. We have indications, however, that we have taken control of the air over Hawaii and that things are not going so bad. One report says that anti-aircraft fire and naval action has bagged 6 Japanese planes and 4 submarines, and there's a report not yet confirmed, I believe, that a submarine carrier has been sunk. Things are spreading over to the other side of the Pacific. We have a report that the Japanese have landed a force on the Isthmus of Kra, and that is the touchy part between Malaya and Siam, which we hope the British would occupy first. The Japanese are there cutting the British in two at the moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard NBC's weekly roundup of the latest news at home and abroad. During the broadcast, you heard Murray Brock speaking to you from Ankara, Turkey, Grant Parr from Cairo, Egypt, Fred Bate from London, Borkage reported from Washington, Bert Silent from Manila, and our final report was by Upton Close from our San Francisco studios. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.
Programs to give you latest news bulletins. Stay tuned to this station.